roughly explain what is the topic. So in a short summary, it's a way to do the numerator, it's a technique to do the numerator algebra when one does loop computations. When you compute loop computation of scattering amplitude in convolutional theory, such as QCD, which will be important for LHC predictions, but it's interesting in itself. When one does loop computation in gauge theory, a terrible bottleneck is that Feynman diagram computation quickly get very, very cumbersome. One reason is the growth of the number of Feynman diagrams, which is very large. Even for a four-point function, there are sort of diagrams with four-point vertices. There's a combinatorially large number of Feynman diagrams. And each of them is complicated because the vertices have very complicated expressions. So the technique I'm going to discuss is a technique to do this numerator algebra. At the loop level, and the technique is based on the fact that the three amplitudes of the theory are very well understood at present. So we're going to build on the three-level amplitude of the theory, and for which three-level scattering amplitude, there exist ways to compute that are much more efficient than Feynman diagrams. They have a lot of structure, and they are a much, much more nicer object than the Feynman diagrams would suggest. So then the strategy is to use this knowledge at tree level. So what does this knowledge at tree level buys us at loop level? So this is the strategy. So this list of papers is the exhaustive list of publication that discuss, I think it's an exhaustive list of papers in the last decade that discuss single cuts. So as you see, there aren't many papers that discuss single cuts. And in giving a lecture, I stick to the rule that I'm only allowed to talk about things that are already in the literature. So that's what I can talk about. And especially, I would be a little biased to those two papers which have my name on it, because I'm more familiar with the content. Mostly going to talk about those two papers. But so why should someone give lectures on the topic that has so few papers on it? So is it because it's not interesting? So, well, that's because it's been largely in development stage. And the reason I believe this is a good time to give a lecture is that very recently this has been applied very successfully to compute loop amplitude, the integrand to loop amplitude in n equals 4 super Young Mills. This is a paper in which this construction I will describe has been applied to n equals 4 super Young Mills and the large NC limit. So this is a very specific theory, but the fact that it works so beautifully well in this case is encouraging and is a thing that it will be useful in other theories as well. So this is the first application so far. So there's at least one successful application of these ideas. So So let me, before I give the rough plan of attack, let me briefly say what the single cuts are. Oh, I don't have an eraser, I guess. Ah, thank you. Thank you. So the physical motivation for single cuts come from, basically, you can use it as a way of doing loop integrals. It was first used by Feynman a while ago in the 60s.
So for this reason, it's related to Carl Feynman tree theorem. So the idea is, say, if you have some loop integral, it's a function of some loop momentum, q, you can, so you have an integral, and you have some integral d for q to do. And if you plot this integral as a function of the complex energy plane, q is your energy in the loop, it says a number of poles, like that. We can allow to move around. And here there will be actually four propagators, four pairs of poles. And you have a contour around it. And one way you can do this contour, the usual way to do this contour is to weak rotate it and then do it as a Euclidean contour. But you can also do it as a contour integral and evaluate it on its residues. If you do that, say, for instance, I close it in the upper half plane, there's nothing at infinity, and I get contribution from four residues. These four residues basically put propagator, they come from propagator. For instance, one of them might come from, might be associated with this factor. And thinking the residue turns this factor into a cup propagator, which is a delta function, 2 pi delta function of q squared. So you have an integral over, so using just contour integration, you can turn into a loop, and you can turn any loop integral into an integral over unshelled particles that are scattering against the rest of the diagram. And here I can draw it on this diagram pictorially, saying that I've cut this propagator, which this cut means this symbol. And so this propagator is unshelled. And now what you have is a unshelled amplitude. And yeah, if you look at what multiplies this object, you can open it. You have two segments, and you see that you have an amplitude with two more particles, but which have equal and opposite momentum. So that way you're relating a loop integral to a loop integral over a phase space of a particle, but with an amplitude with two more particles added in the forward limit. So Feynman used that historically to show that in gauge theories, you don't have to know what the off-shell formulation of the theory is to know what the loop integrand is. So you could derive what the correct loop integrand was in Young-Mills and gravity, and then show that by introducing ghosts in the theory, you could reproduce these objects, this integrand, using an off-shell formulation. So Feynman used that to invent the ghosts. That's what led him to the ghosts. In the modern way, we're going to do the same thing backward. The loop amplitude with ghosts and everything and off-shell information are complicated objects. We want to use this backward to just get directly to the loop integrand and skip all this complicated numerator algebra and get directly to the loop integrand from this data, because now we understand this three-level scattering amplitude much better than people did in the time of Feynman. So we want to use this knowledge. So this is what the single cuts are. And by contradistinction, a double cut or unitarity cut would be a graph in which you cut two of them, which are also known to lead to methods to compute loop amplitude. So this method also been successfully applied to compute loop integrands by California-based group Zwiebern, most notably by Zwiebern, Lance Dixon, and papers written by this group over the past 15 years. So this idea also works using double cuts, using unitarity to construct loop integrands. But today I'm going to focus on those methods that have been used more recently and that just cut one propagator. So is the plan for today and the lectures to come? So the first thing I'm going to discuss is it's going to be a little technical and perhaps less physically illuminating, but I'm going to do some I epsilon ology to, I told you can do these things with contour integrals and so on, but right, what do the I epsilons become when you do that? It's not trivial, so it's worth talking about. There's a nice way to do that, actually. And then I want to discuss what happens when you apply this to two loops and higher. So, okay, it's all nice, you can do it at one loop, but if it stops there, it's not that interesting. So to prove that you can do it at higher loops. And here, there will be an interesting feature that will happen. We'll see qualitative difference between planar. So for the first time, we'll see a difference between planar and non-planar theories arise at weak coupling. And then I will discuss how do you compute these single cuts. So we need actually some technologies. I said there's a forward amplitude with two more particles. So can we actually evaluate this object? What do we know about this object directly from on-shell data? That's the plan for today. And then hopefully I will have time to cover some example, at least to show how it works for, I think I can, if I have time, I can do a four-point function, 4.1, 4-point scattering amplitude at one loop on the blackboard, which is the equivalent of the computation I sketched before, but done much more efficiently. If I don't have time, then that will be tomorrow. And for the remaining of the week, I will discuss about how this thinking leads to recursion relation that are analogous to the BCFW, Brito, Cacciazzo, Frank, Feng, and Witten recursion relations that work so well at tree level, how you can get analogous recursion relation at loop level for loop integrants. And so all of this is quite general quantum field theory. And then as I would go on, things would become more and more n equals 4 centric because that's where the data is at the moment. That's where we have data. Then that's for the rest of the week. So let me get started with the I epsilon ology. So, the formula we would like to write down that you can compute a loop amplitude from some Dielitz integral is that one loop amplitude with n particles with momenta go to n should be equal to some Dielitz integral d3q over 2 pi q 2eq of some tree level amplitude with n plus 2 particles p1 pn added in the forward limit. So this is sort of the formula we want. And now we want to make sense of the I epsilons on this side. I think I'm just going to write a 1/2 here for fun this stage. This is the formula we want to make sense of. So this is a formula with just one cut propagator on shell. If you try to do this using time order boundary condition, then that will not work. The reason is, let me do it here. The try to do it using just say, if you say that this would be time order here and this is time order here, then the thing is, let's just make a contour integration argument. So there are poles that look like this. Yes. The poles are in pairs. Let me put all the poles on the real axis. Then see this pole is paired with this pole. This pole will be paired with this pole, and let me say that there's another propagator here that this pole is paired with this pole. This is something that can happen. Then the contour is supposed to go under this pole. And above the three poles on the right. So the contour does something like that. Hopefully I've chosen a right, correct example that will illustrate the problem. And the thing is, when you
this is one integration contour.
So let me erase the whole thing, it's more confused. Okay, let me erase. Yeah, this is to say that they come from the same propagator. Yeah. Yeah. So let me use colors now. This is the axis, the Q0 axis. This are some poles that are paired in this way. I'm starting to talk about a triangle as opposed to a box. So if you have three propagators, I have six poles. Okay, and now here's the contour of integration. The thing that happens is if you consider this contour here, then if you put this as your origin, this is your Q here. Then as you move in phase space, there will be places where those two crosses cross each other. Then yeah, the crossing is always such that this pole remains, the contour is always squeezed between the two, such that it's always, this pole is always below the integration axis. Yeah, okay. Let me go. Do you have a question? Yeah. That will only happen if Q vector is equal to zero, or if some very particular space-time momentum in some other pole happens. Yeah, that can happen, but there's nothing special at zero in the frequency plane. Yeah. So here, if the first time we do this, there's no problem. When you will run into a problem is that when you do contour integral, you have this term here, which you write as a delta function of this, plus a term in which you have this, so we can do this contour integral in steps. The first step is fine. When you do it, there's a delta function, and this guy is below. This guy is below as it has to be. Those guys are above as they have to be. But when you do the second pole here, you will have When you do the second pole here, you're here, and this guy is at the wrong place for a time order function. See, so you've taken the first pole, you've moved across there. Then when you take the second pole here, this guy is the wrong place. It's no longer a time order propagator because your contour passes above its two poles. If it were a time order propagator, it would be in between. So as you go across and compute more poles, more and more poles, the poles that you have already used are the wrong place. So the formula doesn't close on time order propagators. Yes.
I'm just saying that the equation of the delta function here is just not time order. Why? So the correct extension, which was worked out by Feynman, if you want to use Feynman boundary condition, then for instance this triangle is equal to a term in which you have three terms in which you have one cut propagator and everything else time order. But then you need extra terms in which you have two cuts, which are needed to account for this mismatch here that was described. And there's an extra term that has three cuts, which can be zero or non-zero depending on your kinematics. So this is the full answer that takes into account this mismatch. But what I'm going to argue, so this formula as such is not true with time order propagators. So that's annoying because then you have many, many more objects. So I think the best way around this is to not consider the time order propagator, but consider instead a closely related object. Consider instead the retarded amplitude instead of time order. I'm going to show quickly that these amplitudes are the same function, the same analytic function, but just in different branch. The reason that retarded amplitudes are better, so what is an amplitude with retarded boundary condition? It's an amplitude in which it's a response. It's called, these amplitudes are well known in the context of many body physics and have been used in past and finite temperature field theory, and they tell you about the response of a system to a perturbation. So the definition of a time order of a retarded amplitude, a retarded correlation function, as opposed to time order one, is what you would get if you have, so the retarded two-point function is the expectation value of two variables, say O1 and X, O2 and 1. It's a commutator with a delta function in between. And this function is well known from linear response theory. It is a function that you get if you have a, physically what this function does is if you prepare initial states to be your vacuum, and you have a perturbation that is, you have a perturbation to it, to the Hamiltonian that is, if you have a little perturbation to the Hamiltonian, you're changing the state O. And if you're looking at how the O1, and if you're looking at how the expectation value of O2 in this state changes, then the expectation value is given by you sandwich O2 between this state and its complex conjugate, which is in which you extend this to linear order in O1, you get the commutator. And since you set your initial condition in the past, you don't have to evolve your state beyond the point Y, which is the argument of O2, which is why this delta function appears. So this function is very natural when you look at the effect of perturbation on an expectation value.
It has a special leg O2, y, which is in the, this is theta of y minus x. Y is my observation point. So this is a very natural function, and it has a natural nonlinear generalization, when you still continue to look at the response with more and more operators, which can be written.
Yeah.
Why is there a tether function? It's because you don't have to evolve the state past the point y when you take this expectation value. So your state has been set up in the past. You evolve it to, so you evolve it using integral up to y of delta h of the change in Hamiltonian. This is your perturbed state. Then you put O2 at the point y. And then you put the complex conjugate here. But you don't need to evolve your state past the point one.
Well, when you calculate this expectation value, it doesn't
say that if you deform the theory after you did the measurement, it will not affect the
measurement. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And whatever you do after your measurement doesn't matter. So you can do this at nonlinear level too, using this definition. And when you do this, for instance, at tree level, so just let's quickly get concrete. So at tree level here, this propagator is just, so this is a two-point function from point x to y. And if you Fourier transform it, it's just your usual propagator, except that usually it's, this is time order, now becomes pi squared minus I epsilon p0. So it's just a different pole structure. The time order propagator is the one that has the poles, one below, one above. And the retarded function is the one that has both the its pole below, so it vanishes when you take its Fourier transform and you are on the wrong side of this function. So there's no difference in the path. So if you set up a perturbation theory at tree level, you calculate a retarded three-point function. Retarded three-point function point function. It depends on the observation point, so there's one leg that's spatial. One spatial leg, and then you build, as usual, you sum over all tree level diagrams. And the thing is, so this is 4 point. The thing is, all propagators are replaced from time order one to retarded one. It's just this and this. Yeah, so this is a retarded propagator with this flow of time. And the physics point I want to make is that this object, there has to be a flow of arrows that connect all the external states to the final states, because that's what tells you that 3 has to be in the path of 4 observation points. So whenever you calculate a retarded function, there's a flow of arrows that go from the external legs to final states. So why is that useful at loop level? Is that, well, the object, when you calculate this correlation function, you can also calculate it at loop level, so it's intrinsically defined. You will always need to have this flow of arrows. So if you have one loop diagram, you say this is my observation point, you will always need to have, from every extended state to the final one, you will need to have a discontinued flow of arrows. But we know we can always cut one propagator using control integration. So if you cut one here, you know, therefore this and this cut propagator, it's delta function of q squared, there's no flow of time in it. So in order for this guy to be in the past, well, all of the arrows have to go like this. So that tells you that there's no way you can cut two propagators. This formula is just one that you can cut. And then all of the arrows are unity fixed, and we're just telling you that the three amplitudes you have to calculate, when you open this up, q minus q before, then all of the arrows are unity fixed. So this is the boundary condition you want to use that
corresponds to a formula like this. Just have one cut propagator per loop. So if you calculate this object, once you declare that both sides are retarded, then you actually have an equality without the need to add these extra terms here. So that in my opinion, is the best way to deal with the IXLM topology. There's some well-defined integral here that lends you into some well-defined function here. Then the next thing to, the next piece of physics to need, yes?
So in terms of the pictures you're throwing in the contour, all you're doing is taking one pole and pulling it through the contour, so there's a delta function for that pole, and everybody else is still the same contour.
Yeah. Yeah, so the picture here, so the way to understand what this picture here becomes is to look at what this object, how this object related to the Euclidean Greek function, which I was about to discuss. Yeah, so erase this. So another way to think to get an object that has the right boundary condition is to take the Euclidean Green's function, and which is defined, say, which is usually defined when all the energies are on this axis, which is usually analytically continue. And if you analytically continue it such that by momentum conservation, you can put all but one on the upper axis and just one downstairs. And if you analytically continue it such that all but one come from above and the other comes from below, then you get an analytic function that has very nice properties and analytic properties in the upper half plane. So this one has a nice analytic in the lower half plane, which tells you that its Fourier transform vanishes or when time, its Fourier transform is partial to lots of delta functions. So here, so if we do that here, what this figure becomes is that now all the
what are the x's?
What are the
x's?
So x's are the external momenta. So this is the external pi 0. So this is p1 0, p2 0, p3 0, pn 0. It's what your external data is in the convex plane. So if you calculate a loop with this external data, what this picture becomes is now each of these pair of poles is on a different. So now the contour is just goes that. So now your contour, you can see it's just this, and you deform it. So yeah, I'm skipping a lot of steps. But the rough idea is the reason you've gone around this I epsilon problem is that everything is separated in nice layers. So when you're in this delta function here, you know, so which corresponds to, oh, I rewrite this. So these are always, so these are the other propagators in the loop. You know they are either retarded or advanced. And there's a well-defined answer which depends on where you are here. So I will not complete this argument. This argument here and with the whole structure was given by Katten in the previous. And yeah, physical interpretation in terms of causality I just given. But the last thing I want to add is that the passage from this to ultimately, you want the A1 loop with time order boundary condition. The passage from here to this is simply an analytic continuation one. Both functions are the same function. That will disappear. So you get the time order one by starting from Euclidean one and wave rotating. You get the time order one by starting from this Euclidean picture. I'm thinking all but one. Yeah. This is retarded. And this is the way you typically get time order function is by doing a wave rotation like that. where if you intend to have, say, three external states with positive energy and three external states with negative energy, you will do that.
And here you will do
exactly that instead. So let's see, you start from different Euclidean data.
I think I'm missing, I'm missing the point of the argument about the retarded Green's function, because it's already, it's, as I understand, I mean, the retarded thing is not the same function as the original one. You're going to say it's an analytic continuation of it.
Yes,
essentially.
Yes.
Over here, it's sort of clear that these other terms, they're just computing discontinuities of the, you're just changing branch on the function.
Yes, exactly.
So is it sort of, is it simply just equivalent to saying you just compute the top line?
Yeah, exactly. You just compute the top line, and then the second line follows from just changing branches in the answer.
Yeah.
That's the correct interpretation. So the first line is the one that has actual content, and the other line is just picking the right fringe.
Yeah. In terms of the consoles, it's just that if you use the time ordered console, then the console you get after doing the cut is no longer time ordered, whereas if you use the retarded function, don't change the function at all. Leave the function, leave the integrand exactly the same. It just do it on a console that's a retarded console. And then when you pull some poles through or pick up a delta function, the console that you're left with is still retarded, whereas if you pull the pulse from the time ordered country, it wouldn't be a time ordered country.
But the functions are different.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do it with those two different controls, you get different answers.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then you can relate them by energy continuation.
So just a general question for you. Your formula involves three amplitudes and a forward limit.
Yes.
So now I understand in some theories this limit is well defined, in others it's not. So could you comment on that? Is the formula true in all theories or just some subtleties?
Yeah. So at this stage, this formula is true in any theory for correlation functions that are off-shell.
Off-shell?
Yeah. For off-shell, this formula is true in any theory. Yeah.
So what if I'd like to be on-shell?
Yeah. So if you want to take the on-shell limit, let me get a fresh board. Yeah. So
when you say it's off-shell, the thing in the integrand, there's two legs on-shell.
Yeah. So all of them are off-shell, and those two are on-shell. Yeah.
So for defining the object, it's sufficient that all the other legs are off-shell for it to be well defined.
Yes. 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 Then what happens is, in the general theory, so that I was planning on discussing this later, but it's important to make this point today, and I don't have a lot of time.
Okay.
So thanks for asking the question. So generally you have a lot of diagrams that contribute to this forward limit. So if this is the leg Q, the leg minus Q, in general you can have some blob, which this are your external states, this is finite diagram, and generally we have diagrams that look like that. So if there's momentum p in the air, then there's a propagator that gives you a 1 over p squared,
right?
Because the momentum is actually cancels here. If p is off-shell, this is absolutely no problem. But if you take p to be on-shell, this is ill-defined. The on-shell limit of this object is not well defined. And this has been a major problem in applying this technique to QCD in the past. This person has made some progress. Rick Gilbaugh also discussed this use, but it's still an open question. In my paper, what I propose around, and at least as a temporary fix, is just the observation that in a supersymmetric theory, so for instance, if this is a gluon, this will be a gluon, these are all gluons, the Suzy theory will get a similar diagram in which you have a gauge node. And I also missed another diagram that looks like that. When you add all these diagrams, Suzy does its job and makes miracle happen. And the sum In the sun, the one of the p-square exactly cancels. So when you have n equals 1 Suzy is enough to make this object well defined. The mean n equals 1 Suzy for a massless particle. So I will tell the story. So this story is completely true in any theory, but it's partial. If you want to go unshell and just without, don't have to think about these diagrams, if you have supersymmetry, you can just go ahead and not have to think.
But so if I understand correctly, I could start with an offshell, even in QCD, I could start with an offshell relation.
Yeah.
And then, well, somehow take this on-shell limit, and so you say if individual terms give me the vertices, but they would have to constant at the end, right? Because the object on the left-hand side is well defined. So I suppose then is it just a question of how to?
Well, the object on the left-hand side is well defined in a way that involves LSD reduction and so on. There's a procedure to make it well defined. So yes, but if you follow the steps of the LSD procedure, it should be possible. So as I said, I'm only supposed to talk about things that are in the literature, and in the literature this is still a non-solved problem. As you see, this is a very young field, and it's very possible that some of these issues will get solved. But they are not yet solved.
The left-hand side, it's not really very well defined, it's the version.
The left-hand side is
divergent when the loop
yes.
is functional.
Yes, but yeah, with a regulator it will be fine. For instance, I'm using Dirac and probe style.
Shouldn't you redo this argument with the regulator?
Yes. Yes. So yeah, and with the same regulator on both sides.
Right.
Yes. Yes. Then yeah, there's nowhere. You know, all I've done is I've done control integral in Q0. And for instance, none of this is for by Dirac. We can still do all that in dimensional regularization. Everything goes through. This step goes completely through. So you just have to use the same regulator on both sides.
It's like the only problems are just being sort of being well defined in tree amplitude is just coming from essentially radiative corrections on the external.
Yes.
And so could you say that somehow supersymmetry is just protecting the external states? That's what's.
Yes. Yeah, it's literally that the. If I write the next sentence, if you have massive particle, then the sort of abstract criterion for these things to go away is that the external state be BPS. That's some supersymmetry. So any state in any massless particle in SUSY preserves some supersymmetry. And it is this preserved supersymmetry which makes these cancellations work.
Great.
This observation was done in the first citation,
right? Yes. Yeah, they use it to in n equals 4 to show that the CSW n-gram match the field theory. So the first thing they did is just try CSW rules to calculate one loop MHV amplitudes, as you know very well, and it turned out to work. And in the second paper, they showed that one would probe abstractly that to work is that CSW produce all the correct single cuts. So we calculate this single cut in CSW. And for them, it was also important that they had SUSY to avoid this problem.
Why not confuse what this is? What I remember was the problem there is that you couldn't do it with the regulator.
Yeah, you couldn't regulate the CSW, the unknown CSW regulator. That's absolutely true. What they actually showed was the unregulated, there was a match of the unregulated things. They didn't show this true regulated equality. Yes, that's true.
Will you?
Yes, in what I will do in the following days? Yeah, I will avoid it by using the fact that n equals 4 is UV finite. You just need n farad regulator, and you can use the Coulomb branch as an n farad regulator.
You will not use the branch.
No. So yeah, I will not use the Dirac. That's my way around this problem.
Just that regulator work for the CSW? Because the integrals are not in local forms.
The sum of the integrals is
the sum of the integrals. Yes. The same,
but no, it's a statement about the sum of CSW in the diagram. Okay, I see people frowning again. If anybody has a question, perhaps what I will be doing, so I have 10 more minutes, so I will not have time to discuss. It's not enough to discuss two loops. And one thing which might be, I don't know how much time I want to spend on this retarded issue. So the main physics point here that I wanted to carry is that the physics content is in these three diagrams, and then the others are just changing, going across branch cuts. So I don't think I need to explain more about retarded amplitude. Now that this point is main. Yeah. So explicitly, yeah. Explicit examples of you go from one branch to the other. For instance, in the paper I calculate the general triangle diagram in d dimensions with massive external states with retarded bounding condition and see how it's related to the time order one. So if you're interested in seeing some explicit examples of that, I refer to the paper. But this actually works in practice. What I should do for the what's my 10 minutes is to discuss something about two this formula. So this question, so far there are two questions about this formula. Okay, the formula is true, how do you use it? And that would be that I will discuss at length in the next lecture. The other thing is, does it have an extension to higher loops? And that I want to argue quickly. Does that make sense to the... The first thing I want to say at two loops is that in a general theory, meaning non-planar, it's not true that you just have to do some d-lips over two particles, you just try to put two particles on shell and integrate over some three amplitudes with d-lips. Q1, Q2, some three amplitude with Q1, Pn, Q1, minus Q1, Q2, minus Q2, which is the first sort of most natural guess to extend this formula. It's not true that such a thing can work. And let me give you an argument. Let us consider a simple diagram in 5-4 theory. And if we try to use the three-level amplitude here on the right-hand side, so suppose we cut this guy and this guy. The three-level amplitude will sum over all Feynman diagrams, and that will involve a diagram that looks like this, or this is Q1, I put the X for Q1 and around for Q2, but there will also be, you cannot invariantly get this diagram without also getting the cross diagram in which you just exchange it those two lengths plus our diagram, so there are four diagrams that you cannot avoid getting. They look like So if you just try to make sense of this, you will always end up symmetrizing under Q1 goes to minus Q1 and Q2 minus Q2. You just try to evaluate this 3 amplitude. So you automatically have these symmetries. On the other hand, if you look at this answer, suppose we do it in 0 plus 1 dimension, and suppose we assume that these particles have different energies, right? So we can, and a priori, this should be a statement about any theory. Let's do it in this theory. So if this has an E1, E2, E3, and this omega going on here, then we can actually evaluate this integral exactly in this theory, and the answer is omega squared minus E1 plus E2 plus E3 squared, where all of them are positive. So this is what you get from the wing integral of d omega 1 . If you do this loop integral in 0 plus 1 dimension, you just get this answer, where all of these e's are positive. And you see, this doesn't have the LH symmetry under interchange of Q1 goes to minus Q1 to the E1 goes to minus E1. There's absolutely no way you can reproduce the answer for this diagram using an object that's symmetrized like that. So a formula like this cannot work at two loops. However, we know from contour integration that we can cut two guys. Just because you have two energy integrals, we can do the two of them by frequencies, like at one loop. So there has to be a non-shell formula for this. And the way this works out is just that the unshell formula doesn't involve just the physical tree amplitude that sums over R. Some unlining. Okay, I cannot write that. Okay, let me have this like this. The way that works out is just that, obviously, you have to include these diagrams with different weights. You just have to not sum all over M with coefficient 1. So what this means is you have the tree amplitude here, but this is really a sum over Feynman diagrams. This tree amplitude is replaced by sum over diagrams. And now you have to weight them differently. And what can you do to weight different Feynman diagrams differently? So the invariant thing that distinguishes those two, that this has a propagator in which Q1 and Q2 add. And this is a diagram in which Q1 and Q2 subtract from each other. So at the level of Feynman diagrams, you can distinguish between the two, and you can weight them differently. So you can sum the diagrams. It turns out that there's a let me write the correct way to weight them. So there's a formula that exists with 2D lips. We know that such a formula had to exist. And the formula turns out to be you have to sum them with 4/3 when they add, with the 2/3 when they subtract. With a 1 when they are also cases
in that case, in that theory, there was no such instance, but you can have diagrams like this, where it just Q1 and Q2 just never share a propagator, and then you just see that it's one average of the other cases. So now let's make sense of this formula. If we try to make sense of this formula again using retarded boundary conditions, then all the I epsilons are fixed by the boundary conditions. So there's no thinking about I epsilon there. This problem, as I said, has nothing to do with I epsilon. It's really an issue about what tree amplitude you have to use. Let's start afresh here. Oh, good. So what does this very particular weighting does for you? So one simple way to check that this is correct is to check that it has the right unitarity cuts. So suppose I have this diagram here, and I try to compute the unitarity cut of this diagram where all those trees are equal. I can have many, so I take these diagrams and I take an imaginary part here. So two of them are cut by the formula, and the other will be cut by, So let's say that we're looking at a region where this energy is, so I have two, oh, I'm over. Oh, that's your phone? Let me, but no, since it's three, let me finish quickly then. Let me get this point through. Suppose I look at an imaginary part that has this energy positive, positive, negative, for instance. I can try to look at the cut here. And then I will have three terms in it. In one term, I will get a contribution from this two-third here, because Q1 and Q2 just have, well, the, yeah. This ellipse is over positive energy and the growth. This diagram in which they add, this term in which there's two-third here. There's a term in which you cut this one and this one. Sorry, let me get that. That can be straight. Yeah, that's correct. Sorry. They add, so that's four-third. That's for guy you did, yeah, so it's four-third. And then in this cut here, take the imaginary part, but there's this cut, they subtract, then I get, there's a term that's two-third, but then this term has a opposite sign from the two, because the imaginary part of the retarded Green's function is opposite that positive and negative energy. So this is, so let me write it first. So this first term I will write as 4/3 times minus 1, because this imaginary part here is negative. And then this plus 2/3 from this cut times plus 1, because the imaginary part here is positive. And then the same thing where this cut, 2/3 times this one, 2/3 equal to 0. So This funny, very funny weighting of diagram answered that there's no imaginary part in this from this unphysical region of integration, which had to be the case. It's that usually in unitarity cut, all energies have the same sign. So that's the first check. And the second check is that if you put all the energies positive, then you indeed get the correct sum. Actually, the way it's normalized, I think you would get 2, so you need, it's just, the remaining case to check just fix the overall normalization of this, which I may not have up here. But the main thing is that the unphysical region has to cancel, and that's fixed the ratio, that fixes the ratio of those two terms. So what do we learn from that? So we learn that at two loops, it's not just the physical tree amplitude that enters this formula. So it's some funny sum over Feynman diagrams weighted by factors. And one thing that one can show is that this sum is not gauge invariant. This is the first thing to ask, is this sum gauge invariant? Well, no. It managed to be in such a way that its gauge dependence integrates to zero, but its gauge dependence is not zero at the integrand level. So for two loops, it seems like you have to integrate over some non... Yeah, so remember, the philosophies that we want to use, the physical tree amplitude that we understand calculate this, but the data that seems to enter a two loop is not a physical tree amplitude, so that's a bad start. So far, the only way to circumvent this is to use... The only solution so far is to go to planar limit. The Taft planar limit. And in this limit, what is special is there's a different way to correlate the energies of those guys. Which basically in the planar limit, if you have a planar two-loop diagram, then the philosophy roughly is that this is a well-defined question whether you're cutting an external leg, and since you're cutting this or this, or whether you're cutting the inside trunk. So this propagator is intrinsically different from, is distinguishable from the other ones. And in planar theory, you can use this to cook up a better formula that will involve only physical tree amplitudes. So let me cook up the formula. I can erase this. So this formula is true in any theory, but it doesn't involve physical data. The formula that would be true in a planar theory, that if you compute the tree amplitude on this side, the planar limit, you have to add. So let that circle be the external state. This is external state 1, 2. So this is the sort of disk portion. Then I can add Q1 minus Q1 and Q2 minus Q2. We can see that if I, yeah, and that would be, and I can put something else here, and whatever. And if I draw a diagram like that, in this diagram, if there's a propagator that has Q1 that involves both Q1 and Q2, then this propagator will have to do with Q2 minus Q1. So with this way of writing things, Q1 and Q2 will be opposite. So you can read off whether you're in this category or in this category just by looking at the color structure of the diagram. There's another color structure. So here, this color structure falls in the subtract class. And the other type of color structure you can have is in which they are nested. We have Q1, Q2, minus Q2, minus Q1, something like that. And in this case, you can easily see that they will add. propagator. So this falls into the add category. But again, I'm using the convention that the energies are always positive. So if you exchange the sign of Q2, then it changes category to the subtract one. So there will also be a diagram in which Q1 minus Q2, Q2 minus Q1, and so on, to just change the sign and so on, change the category. So in the planar gauge theory, you have this freedom. And you can use this to write a formula that involves only physical tree amplitudes that has all the right unitary cuts, and that is also that we can derive from contour integration directly. This is no longer a thing. Yeah. And the sort of physical way to think about this diagram is that this is a diagram in which you started from some diagram in double line notation in which you've cut two propagators on the outside. That gives you this, gives you this, this gives you this. And this is a diagram in which you've cut the trunk. That gives rise to this color structure. So the physical principle which makes it possible is really that you can distinguish the trunk from the external legs in the planar theory. But the bottom line is that in planar theory, you have expression like that, not old, and the right-hand side is some physical quantity that you can calculate from physical tree amplitude. And if there's not this problem with the on-shell limits as before, and so if you have Susie, then this is a well-defined object on the right-hand side. So the bottom line is that in the Susi planar gauge theory, the two loop amplitudes are equal to integral over phase space of two particles times some physical amplitude that you can calculate efficiently. So in the next lectures, I'm going to use this physical insight to then at this stage, the question becomes, how do you do this in the most efficient manner? And so how do you start from this data and construct the loop amplitude in the most efficient way? And the most efficient way would turn out to be to construct an off-shell loop integrand using recursion relations. So hopefully next day I will be able to provide less groundwork and more examples. Thank you.